Welcome, dear readers. You're listening to Time to Read, a Winnipeg Public Library podcast book club. We're recording today from the Millennium Library in Winnipeg, which is within Treaty 1 territory, the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, and Dakota, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. Our drinking water comes from Shoal Lake 40 First Nation in Treaty 3 territory. In this episode, we will be discussing The Death of Vivek Oji by Akweki Emezi. I'm Dennis from the Idea Mill, and if my story were a stack of photographs, then a huge chunk of it would probably be moldering in a storage box in a basement somewhere. Across the table from me is...
Hi, I'm Toby. I'm an outreach librarian based out of here at Millennium Library, and if you two are making any weird comments, I might start sucking my teeth at you. So if you hear any weird sounds, that's just me.
Well, I'm Trevor, the branch head at the Louis Riel Library, and a Nigerian proverb I came across is, words are sweet, but they can never replace food.
Agreed.
A good book can carry me away from an average and ordinary day.
Dear readers, we wouldn't do this without you. We love hearing your opinions about the books we're reading, so tell us your secret thoughts that no one else knows. You can find our email address and all our social media outlets by going to wpl-podcast.winnipeg.ca and scrolling to the bottom of the page. If you hang around till the end of the episode, you can enjoy our special segment, Nerd Words for Word Nerds. Before we get into the episode, let's do a little check-in.
Yeah, well, hey, how are you guys?
You know.
Yeah.
Surviving. Doing all right. I turned 50 just a couple of weeks ago, so Yay. It's a bit of a milestone for me.
That's excellent.
Full half century now.
Yeah. Did you celebrate it in any way during these COVID times?
Yes, at home quietly with my wife and my cat.
Oh, that sounds like
Which a is the way, way we usually celebrate it. So, you know, it worked out great. My wife made steaks. It was great.
Ah, nice. Well, we're talking about the podcast, and our listeners may be interested to know that we've been nominated as a finalist for a Canadian Online Publishing Award in the category of Best Podcast Series in the Consumer Division. So yay for us, I guess.
Yeah.
I happened to look at the other nominees in our category just to see what we're up against. You know, they're pretty solid podcasts. There's one that's called, there's two that are French and two that are English plus ours. So the first French one is called Complan 101, which translates into Conspiracies 101. So that's right at my wheelhouse, misinformation from Quebec. So, I mean, yes, you know, I'm on board with them. Then another one's called En Privé, s'il vous plaît, which it translates to In Private, Please. And from what I can tell, this is two young women in Quebec discussing issues of the day. I don't know if that, you know, it's the same caliber as what we have to offer. But then this one, I'm a little worried about. It's called The Well-Endowed Podcast by the Edmonton Community Foundation, which talks about different community outreach initiatives in Edmonton. And they seem like they're doing lots of great work. And the last one is just a five-part series. So a limited series called The Sound Aquatic. And it's just, as far as I could tell, a bunch of marine biologists who have been recording the sounds of the ocean and telling us what it's all about.
I don't know if we can beat out ocean sounds.
Well, I know. You know, I mean, we were mesmerized by the Island of Sea Women when we did that one. So that's sort of our, either we want to think of them as our competition or as our comrades in the over the airwaves, but good luck to all of the nominees. And I think in February we may find out whether ocean sounds beat us. Mm-hmm. The sound of like a manatee, the lone mournful whale of manatee.
I don't have anything to respond to that. I do want to say I'm excited about a book that I got ordered for the system. I recently wrote a blog post for the Winnipeg Public Library blog about Book Talk, which is this niche of TikTok dedicated to all things books. And a book that's very popular on Book Talk that we didn't have in our collection is something called Ice Planet Barbarians. and so I ordered it for our system. It's on the way, so you can put it on hold. And it is a romance about this spaceship full of women that crash on an alien planet. And there's some like alien human sex going on. Yeah. So if
the manatee approves.
So I would suggest putting your holds on that now before all the youths who are hip to the book talk also get their holds on it.
Wow, I love that title.
Yeah, it's a great title. And I think there's like 20 books in this series. So
possible future time to read totally. Pick, perhaps.
Yeah. Ice Planet Barbarians.
We'll get the TikTok crowd in on our listening.
Yeah.
So now it's time for Trevor to give us a summary of the book. But actually, Trevor will wait a moment while Toby tells us a bit about the author.
Okay, Akweke Emezi. This was a bit challenging to write, as there's not a lot of straightforward biographical information about them. So, for instance, their bio on their website says that they are an artist and writer based in liminal spaces whose art practice is located in the metaphysics of black spirit and uses video, performance, writing, and sculpture to create rituals processing their embodiment as a non-human entity and Obanji, a deity's child. So I'll try to unpack that a bit. Emezi was born in 1987 to an Igbo Nigerian father and an Indian Tamil mother. They grew up in Aba, Nigeria, where Emezi and their sister used storytelling to escape the dangerous reality of their childhood. These dangers are detailed in their memoir, which just came out this year and includes the town burning due to riots, as well as a heap of decomposing bodies outside the teaching hospital. Emezi was a voracious reader as a child and began writing short stories at 5. They moved to the U.S. at 16, studied international public policy and nonprofit management at New York University and creative writing at Syracuse. Their first novel, Freshwater, was published in 2018. It is a semi-autobiographical novel about a young Nigerian woman named Ada who has different selves as a result of being born with one foot on the other side. Their second novel, Pet, published in 2019, is a young adult novel about a black trans girl. The Death of Vivek Oji was published in 2020. All of these received heaps of critical acclaim. This year, they published Dearson Thurin, a black spirit memoir. Next year is going to be extremely busy. In 2022, they are publishing a romance, the screen rights of which have already been sold, a poetry collection, and a YA novel. So if you weren't keeping track, that is 7 books in 5 genres in 4 years. Wow. If you do any sort of research or reading about Emezi or their work, you see the term Obanji referenced over and over again. Emezi says they are an Obanji, and it's pretty crucial to their life and work. So I just wanted to get into that a little bit. So Obanji is an Igbo spirit. Igbo are the people primarily living in southeastern Nigeria. So an Igbo spirit that's born into a human body. It's kind of a malevolent trickster whose goal is to torment the human mother by dying unexpectedly, only to return in the next child and do it all over again. Igbo believes everyone to be in a cycle of reincarnation with their ancestors, but the Obanji disrupts this cycle. They do not come from the lineage. They come from nowhere. And Emezi ties the fact of them being an Obanji with also being transgender. They are quoted as saying, did Obanji even have a gender to begin with? Gender is, after all, such a human thing. And so Obanji is this in-between entity, and Emezi is in between genders, and all of this in-betweenness is really central to their work. So I just wanted to wrap this up with a quote that Emezi often talks about. It's by Toni Morrison, and it goes, I stood at the border, stood at the edge, and claimed it as central. Claimed it as central and let the rest of the world move over to where I was.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
The summary of the death of Vivek Oji. They burned down the market the day Vivek Oji died. That's the first sentence of the novel. It's also the entire first chapter. What follows is the tumultuous, heart-wrenching story of one family's struggle to understand a child whose spirit is both gentle and mysterious. Raised by a distant father and an understanding but overprotective mother, Vivek suffers disorienting blackouts, moments of disconnection between self and surroundings. As adolescence gives way to adulthood, Vivek finds solace in friendships with the warm, boisterous daughters of the Niger wives, foreign-born women married to Nigerian men. But Vivek's closest bond is with Osita, the worldly, high-spirited cousin whose teasing confidence masks a guarded private life. As their relationship deepens and Osita struggles to understand Vivek's escalating crisis, the mystery gives way to a heart-stopping act of violence in a moment of exhilarating freedom. What does it mean for a family to lose a child that they didn't really know?
So how did you guys find the book?
I feel like because I'm the one responsible for us reading this book that I should go first. I liked this book, but I didn't enjoy reading it, if you get my drift. It wasn't a book that I would reach for at the end of the day and think, yes, I get to read another chapter of this book. I liked it. I think the writing is really strong. The writing's super vivid and beautiful. It's just, I didn't find there was any hope in this book. I mean, I think Amisi does talk about how they do think there is some hope, and there is a little bit, but I just found it very sad. And because it's written quite poetically, it's not like a page turner, you know, it's not that I didn't enjoy it because it's sad or depressing. It's just, I liked it. Oh, I'm not being very clear. I liked it, but I just, it was not a joy to read.
No, I get it. And yeah. This is one of those books where I'm reminded about the value of book clubs, because without this podcast or this group, I don't think I would ever have known about this book or had this author on my radar. And so I was introduced to a whole different culture, a whole different world. And yeah, I seem to be the contrarian today. I did find it like a page turner, in that I found it was almost like we had a jigsaw puzzle, and we had all these pieces, but we had lost the box. So we didn't know what the picture was. And we only had these individual pieces that somehow we tried to put together. And then partway through the book, it's like, well, maybe, okay, we don't have all the pieces. We're going to have to make do with what we have. And I love the analogy at the very beginning of the book that was, if this story were a stack of photographs, this is the first one you'd see. And I felt that not only does the idea of photographs play a huge plot point towards the climax of the novel, but it also gave the sense that these are different stories, perhaps from different times, and they're all pulled together almost in this mosaic. And I found the book, sort of like what Toby said, like very stressful to read. There were moments of tension that I felt the author did extremely well in drawing out, like just the whole scene when they go to Auntie Kavita with the photos, and I couldn't put the book down because I'm like, what, how is this going to play out? So for that, I was grateful for reading it. Again, I spent quite a bit of time on Google Street View, as I do with books. And amazingly, Nigeria does not have a great network, or maybe understandably, of Google Street View. Many of the places have not been mapped. And the curious thing is that if you go virtually on any Google Street View in Nigeria, if you turn the camera 360 degrees, there is a police car behind the Google car. And I looked into it because if you look up, and part of the reason is because if it didn't have a police escort, there was a very good chance that the car would be ransacked as it was driving around. So if anyone's interested, go check it out. You'll see the police. Sometimes it's an SUV, and sometimes it's like maybe two car lengths back. And so it's something interesting. I learned from this book.
I liked this book, but I didn't love this book. There are a lot of things I did love in this book. A lot of the use of language, the way that they integrated Nigerian pidgin into it. And it's like, as an English speaker, you can pick out and get an understanding of it, but there's still stuff I felt like I missed. I thought the descriptions of grief in this book were so vivid and authentic. Like I really felt the grief of the characters in a way you don't always feel in a book, or at least that I don't always feel in a book. A lot of aspects to this I liked. Other things, like, I kind of felt like some threads just dropped here and there and picked up here and there, and it wasn't as cohesive a story as I would have liked. So, you know, I have some reservations about parts of it, but overall I liked this book, and I did enjoy getting the different cultural things from Nigeria. Yeah, it's a complicated book in some ways, right? There's so many different pieces. One of the things that I was divided on is the way that, like, you know that there's something with Vivek. Says so right at the beginning. Doesn't tell you what for the longest time, and you're just kind of piecing together, is it just a malaise about life, just depression? I say just, I don't mean to minimize that, but is it like that straightforward? And it's like, is Vivek gay? Is, you know, I suspected there would be a transgender connection at some point from some of the initial imagery, I guess. But nothing's really clear right up until the end. And then, like, the last chapter with Osita, you finally get the picture of what actually happened on the day. And it's not what I pictured at all. Like, I didn't know exactly what it would be, but that wasn't it. I still found it a satisfactory end. But it's, yeah, it's complicated and layered and imperfect. but overall, I like that.
And I agree with you about sort of the incomplete feel, but again, that to me, it feels like that was intentional, that the story wasn't sort of told to us in a traditional conventional timeline, that we are only getting bits and pieces, and some sections are extremely intense. Like some of the love scenes, I found myself just feeling like I was sharing like a very intimate moment with these characters, that I almost like, I felt like I shouldn't be reading this with these characters. This is a private time for them. And then I thought it was very, very skillful how the book would then, the next chapter would pull back. And then again, you'd get almost a superficial, one of my favorite chapters of all, I may note, it was chapter 16. And it was the whole story of Ebenezer, the vulcanizer, who was the chap who was fixing tires, and how, you know, his wife and him, they were wanting to have kids, but it was unclear if the fertility problems were with him or with his wife, but he was too proud to go to the hospital to get checked. And then he sort of started this sort of relationship with the woman that was running the little cafe across the street. But there was so much sort of like so many poor role models in this book in terms of people that are honest in their relationships and trustworthy, that this story was a little gem, because sure, he was tempted by this woman and he was, you know, but then the fire and the riot starts, that he goes and he knows his wife is at the market, and he goes and she's so surprised to see him, and he's there and says, "I'm here, like, I'll help you out." And then I just feel like that whole little chapter was just like a nice, almost a little vignette of this person's kind of journey. And I in my head, I've written a very happy ending for Ebenezer and his wife. What did you guys think of that little? But it felt kind of apart from the story, except for one point where he says he notices a woman, a tall, you know, dark woman walking down the street and stuff, and they talk about that. Of course, we find out later it's Vivek. What did you guys think of that little sort of aside chapter?
Like Dennis mentioned earlier, the kind of loose threads, and I found like that as an example of it. Like, it seems a lot to have this whole interlude with just the express purpose of kind of a morality tale, but also I think more the fact that, you know, there's Vivek walking through it, the girl with the long hair. So I just felt it kind of came out of nowhere and it just didn't fit in. I enjoyed that chapter. I thought it was one of the most readable bits, but it seemed like it didn't fit in with anything else that was going on in the novel. And I mean, we're not getting a linear story here. We're jumping around in time. We are jumping through different narrators. And that was just another time where I was like, okay, we get this one thing and then we never hear about it again. Like, you know, I think about Vivek's fugues, you know, it's such a integral part of the beginning. And then there's no resolution about what that is. I thought it was strange that we really didn't hear much about characters like Juju and Olun and Somtu until the middle, and then they became very pivotal at that point. So just bits that were a little awkward to me.
I felt that about a lot of segments of the book, and that particular chapter, it was a little disorienting. Like, why are we now focused on this guy? We're spending a lot of time with this guy. Whoa, it's okay. There's Vivek. Okay, now still with this guy. Was it just for the glimpse of Vivek? It was a little disorienting. And as we're talking about it, I feel like that maybe is one of the themes of the novel, this whole disconnection thing that happens. Like, nothing's ever completely settled in this book, which I guess is a way of, you know, an analogy to Vivek, who eventually is Nimdi, not really being settled, and none of the relationships being really settled either. It's always a bit in motion. That kind of thing connects with me or appeals to me in some levels. Not that I'm transgender or in the same environment, but I connect with it on the kind of the malaise of life kind of feeling that Vivek had. There's this one quote in the first half somewhere where he talks about how his life, it's felt like he's kind of been twirled through concrete, and first he's managing to just go through it and a little slowly, but then it starts sticking to him and he starts getting weighed down. And to me, that felt like an analogy for life, because that's how I often feel about life, just weighed down by all the things that get to you. So it felt very universal there. And that type of story has always appealed to me. Stories of people who are just struggling to cope with the world. To give an example, like there's a movie from the 80s called The Survivors with Robin Williams and Walter Matthau. It's a terrible movie, objectively. Like, you watch this movie, it is terrible. But there's one scene at the end where Robin Williams' character has an emotional breakdown. And Robin Williams was always brilliant about performing this type of thing. And for that one moment, this became one of my favorite movies, even though the rest of the movie really isn't that good. Like, you shouldn't watch it. Don't go out and watch it, even if you can find it. But for me, that type of thing really connects. And that was part of what I liked about the book, is the way the characters were just struggling to cope with life and with themselves. And so I feel like even if you're not into trans issues or cultural issues with Nigeria specifically or things like that, that it's still very relatable to a lot of people. And I feel like I've wandered off the topic a little bit here.
Well, just to pick up what you're saying, Dennis, is that it seemed like the characters, including Vivek, they never felt comfortable in their own skins. And maybe we can talk a little bit about the language and the pronouns, which I found interesting in the book, that to my knowledge, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think the term trans or transgender is ever used in the novel. We're sort of shown, not told, Vivek's conflict or his maybe despair of just not knowing why he is the way he is. I just say he because for most of the novel, he's referred to as a he by his friends, his family. And then very interestingly, in that chapter that you're talking about, Dennis, where Osita kind of tells the whole story uninterrupted of what happened on that day at the market, I believe that's the first and maybe only time that Vivek's referred to by his other name, Nendi, and the pronoun she, which at the very end, after he dies, it feels like at that point, it's almost like he's freed. She's freed. They're freed from the constraints of what they were living under. And does that explain the fugues? I don't know. I mean, there's even like almost a spiritual element that may come from the author's Nigerian belief system that perhaps Vivek is an incarnation of his grandmother because of this starfish shaped scar that they both share. And so that's an interesting component. It's sort of there. It's not really developed beyond just maybe this is something that it's going on. So how did you guys feel about the pronouns and how we never get a very clear definitive answer as to Vivek Oji?
Yeah, that was something I wondered about right at the end, because it only really becomes obvious right at the end. And so I was wondering, as we were going into the podcast, how do we refer to Vivek or Nnamdi? Because, you know, you get used to calling someone something through your association with them. And I guess that's one of the complicated things about transitioning, is all these people who knew you one way have to transition to referring to you another way. And it is a mentally challenging exercise, which I experience here, because I experience Vivek as Vivek for the whole novel right up until the end. And then it's like, oh no, Vivek wants to be Nnamdi. Nnamdi is the happy version, the version that feels complete to Nnamdi. But in my mind, it's still Vivek, because that was the whole novel, right? So that's an interesting experience, because I don't personally know anybody who's transitioned. So I haven't had to make that mental adjustment in person with anybody that I know. Although I should say I do know one person online who I only know online who transitioned. But that was a little easier because I've never met them and didn't have the same kind of baggage of my own to go with that. So, yeah, I found that experience interesting. And I guess a small taste of what maybe it would be if someone I know does transition. But yeah, I don't feel entirely comfortable with it, because I still haven't made that switch, even with this book, although I only finished it yesterday, so that I haven't had a lot of time to process.
I mean, I think at its core, this book is a mystery. It's a mystery of who killed Vivek. You know, it's Kavita as, you know, trying to figure out who killed her child. But then I think there's also the mystery of what exactly is happening with Vivek. And I mean, I came into this book knowing that that's what it was about. I mean, the author is non-binary transgender. I read the description, I heard about it. So I knew that this was the story of transgender person who is unhappy and who does get killed. I mean, you can't avoid it from the title in the first chapter. So that gave me an idea of what I was going into. And I'm curious if you didn't know that and you started reading this book, how that experience would be different. I mean, I think because we're presented with Vivek as a male, as a he for the majority of the book, and then it's only at the end where that switches. I feel like it's okay to refer to them as he. I know people who are trans, and the interesting thing, well, what I find interesting is that when someone transitions and it has new pronouns, you refer to them always as the new pronouns, even when you're referring to them as a child or in the past when they might not have been, you know, transitioned, you still refer to them as their preferred pronouns in the present. But that's not what happens in this book. You know, Vivek, I mean, I guess Vivek doesn't even have the time to really fully transition. So I don't know. It is tricky. It's tricky.
And for me, that final scenario really brought me back to the first sentence of the book. They burned down the market the day Vivek OG died. And it made me think that, well, that was the first day that Vivek went out in the dress as Namindi or felt comfortable to go out beyond her bubble, which all of her friends were saying, no, you can live this way, but just live this way with us. You don't go out into the world. And so in some ways, Vivek OG died before Vivek OG died that day, that it was the day that she was comfortable enough with herself to go out and to go to the market and be seen. And it just sort of gave a new layer to that first sentence, maybe, that the death, there were more deaths that happened that day than just the physical death.
And also that first line in the book, correlation is not causality, but when I read it, I thought that there was some connection, like, oh, Vivek OG died and people were so upset they burnt down the market. Yeah. Like, that was my mindset going into it. And it's like, oh, okay, this is not directly related, and the riot. And then I thought, okay, well, the riot's happening. The riot causes Vivek's death, and that's the connection. And it's like, nope, it turns out that's not it either.
Well, that's the mystery, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I know. You're going through the whole thing, and it's like, in the end, it was like Osita's fear of what would happen to Namdi / Vivek that caused an accident, a tragic accident, a fluke. What are the odds you fall and hit your head on a rock? You know, what are the odds that kills you? It's such a tragic accident, and that's what happened. And you only know right at the end. So spoilers.
Well, and the other thing about that first sentence too is it's an example, but it happens throughout the book, is it really forced me to sort of check my preconceptions or ideas at the door, because I knew this book took place in Nigeria. And so when I heard about a market burning down, my first thought is, okay, this is a story that takes place in the 1800s, because you hear about a market. So this must be like a historical novel. And then, of course, you get into it and they're talking about, you know, I don't know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and they're talking about, you know, video games and things. So I'm like, no, this is either present day or very close to present day. And that's just one small example, again, how it's sort of the timing is, maybe you think one thing and it's something else, and you're challenged. You're just challenged throughout the book with your conceptions, which made it, to me, a page turner, even though it was so hard to read in some parts.
Yeah. And also the cultural differences, like the fact that they never really got into the reincarnation thing with Ahuna to Vivek beyond mentioning it a couple of times, I think is maybe because for the author, this is culturally assumed. Like, this is the way it is. And there were a lot of other things that were, I assume for a reader from Nigeria, would just make more sense. Like, yeah, that makes sense. For me as a Canadian reader, not familiar with Nigerian culture at all, there's all these things that just leave me a little uncertain as to what they're referring to. And a lot of my assumptions are just off because I'm not familiar with the culture. I like that kind of thing. Like, I like being exposed to another culture and not being entirely familiar with it, so that I could just kind of soak some of it in and not have maybe the usual questions and assumptions in my mind. Like, because I'm aware, okay, I'm probably missing something here, but I'll just roll with it. But yeah, that was an interesting aspect to the book. And like I say, I loved the Nigerian pidgin phrases and things that were in the book. Like, one of my favorites is at the beginning when Chika is getting up the nerve to talk to Kavita, I think it was. But they didn't say get up the nerve or have the guts. It was he had the liver to do it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, I like that. I don't know why, but I like the phrase.
I definitely like those little things too. It reminded me when I was a kid, and if I read, say, a book by a British author, and in the book they would use the term petrol instead of gas, or they would say lorry instead of truck, I felt like it was like a secret code that I was sort of in on, and I loved that part of that. And also in this book too, all the sort of phrases, I've had to look up things, and some things you could figure out in the context, and others, they didn't spoon feed you these phrases and things. It was very much a natural part of the dialogue, and it was just added that layer of what felt like authenticity to a complex story.
Yeah, and just to backtrack a little bit, I think another cultural thing that we need to have as an umbrella over all of this is that, from what I understand, Nigeria is very homophobic and very transphobic. Mm-hmm. And so Vivek being trans, the risk that he, she, they take to go outside, you know, with the wig or the long hair, you know, to talk to his or her, their parents about this, like the risks are just so much greater. Like, this would be an entirely different novel set somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the things I had to remember too, reading it, was like, you know, if this were a contemporary novel taking place in North America, there wouldn't be the same risk, like literal risk to the life, for this type of situation. I mean, it still happens even in North America, in Europe, you know, there are still risks for people that make that transition depending on their particular family or friends. But in some countries, it is very much extremely dangerous.
Yeah, that's written into the criminal code as something that they could be, you know, arrested for, not even just like mob violence, but it's considered illegal.
Yeah. And that puts another spin on it and reminds us, you know, things aren't always the same here as they are everywhere else.
Yeah. And I mean, we read about these photos of Vivek in dresses and makeup, and we think, oh, that's nice. You know, they're expressing who they truly want to be. But like, what if those are found? You know, that could be very serious for Vivek and his family.
Yeah. And the family already had tensions too, with when the sister-in-law, Mary,
yeah.
Got Vivek to their church. Oh, and yeah, it was one of those places that does, I forget what the official term they use for it.
Kind of conversion,
like
therapy.
Exorcism.
Well, yeah. Yeah, like an exorcism where they were trying to literally beat the spirit out of him. Mm-hmm. And that takes place in other places in the world too. There, I've read about churches in the U.S. that conduct that same type of violence against their parishioners. It's always dangerous. Like, people die from that. And that was without knowing that Vivek was trans. You know, that's just not right. He's not normal. He needs to get a bad spirit out of him. And that justified beating him. And the family dynamics, that was another thing that really struck me in this book. Like, the family dynamics were so complicated and delicate. Yeah, I'm fortunate not to have that kind of difficulty in my family relationships, but I know that other people have more complicated relationships, and the ones in this book were just very interesting.
Well, I really liked the characterization of Vivek's parents, because I could relate so much. I mean, they were imperfect, but they loved Vivek, mm-hmm. and they just wanted him to be happy, and they wanted to help him, but they didn't know how, because they didn't understand what was going on. In fact, like Vivek's friends were like, you're asking the wrong questions. If you start asking the right questions, maybe we can help you. But and especially the mother, who that very powerful, maybe the most powerful scene in the entire novel for me, was when she just busts up the tombstone. Mm. Because she realizes that, you know, she failed her child in life, but in death maybe she can honor them. And the change in the inscription from beloved son to beloved child, to me, just really, that hit home in such a powerful way. But yeah, they weren't perfect, of course. They were very well, I thought, fleshed out, complex, like you said, Dennis, characters. And
like the book jacket described Chika as distant. It was hard for me to gauge Chika because he was reserved in a lot of ways. But the way he was overwhelmed by first the death of his mother and then the death of his child, I connected with that again. Like, he felt like a person who was very sensitive, actually, and withdrew because of that sensitivity to the world. And yeah, the mother, who couldn't see anything objectively, is just, everything was seen through the filter of her love for her family and her intense desire that they be okay, especially Vivek. Like, She wanted Vivek to be okay and couldn't really brook any idea that would interfere with that. So she couldn't see a lot of things that were happening, and Vivek didn't feel safe coming to her or coming to his father. And the interest, like with their response afterwards, you wonder, could they have come forward? Could it have worked? You'll never know. But it was understandable for Vivek not to feel comfortable coming forward, especially with all the cultural expectations and because of Kavita's and Chika's, you know, individual flaws. So very dynamic.
That just reminded me of another loose thread, I thought, from the beginning when Chika hits on Mary.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, like this is an interesting dynamic here. What's going to happen? And then it just falls off and we never hear about it again.
Mm. Yeah. The one imagery thing that did kind of follow through was at the beginning, it was if a story were a stack of photos, which, you know, it kind of bugged me at the beginning. It just reminded me of the Golden Girls, you know, picture it, Sicily, 1942. Just picture, picture, picture. And then no more pictures for most of the book until the end where the pictures were shown to Kavita. And that was where she found the truth. And so there was a tie in there, but there was this whole section in the middle where there were no pictures anymore. Before we move on to our next section, anybody have any final kind of wrap up comments about the book? Would you recommend the book to anybody?
Like I said, I liked it, but I didn't enjoy reading it. So no, it's not a book I would run out and be like, oh, I just read this great book. You have to read it. But if someone was looking for something that dealt with trans issues or a book set in Nigeria, I think it's very well written. And I am interested to read other titles by this author.
Yeah, I have a similar feeling to Toby about the book that I maybe would be maybe not hesitant to recommend it, but I would have to recommend it to somebody who I felt could really get something out of it. So I wouldn't just sort of make a blanket, this is a must read book of, but I would, if there's somebody I felt that was struggling with their identity, struggling with the world, or I guess it's everyone these days, but I would recommend it for that because it shows that you're not alone. It shows that the world, you don't have to conform to the world. You can, like that quotation from Toni Morrison, you can make the edge your center. Vivek's case maybe didn't work out till the very end, but that's sort of the beautiful part of the book, that she did have that moment where, that brief moment where she did bend the world to her identity and not the other way around. And that although it ends in tragedy, well, it begins in tragedy, I did feel there was hope in that maybe the family understands a bit more. And I found too, like the outpouring of grief for Vivek afterwards, all the people coming over with the food and the family. And if only Vivek could have seen that, the love that was in the community, but they didn't have a way to express it. They didn't have the words, they didn't have the vocabulary, and of course the culture, it was prohibitive for him to come forward. But those weren't really final thoughts, those were more final ramblings. So I'm going to stop there.
Yeah, I'll say, I enjoyed it. I didn't love it, but I do think it's a good book if, you know, someone is looking for something a little different. Something that's not a standard genre novel, something with different perspectives. If you just want something interesting that's out of your ordinary, or probably out of your ordinary reading style, then I think this is a good one to try. It was not too long. The writing is really good and smooth and easy to get through. It's not complicated that way, but there's a lot of emotional depth and character depth to it, and a lot of things that you'll probably think about afterwards in different ways. And so it's thought provoking. So if you're interested in a thought provoking, interesting book that's easy to read, I think it's good. It's imperfect, but I think that's also part of the point. So since 1 year is ending and another year beginning, we're going to do our annual reading resolution segment instead of our usual book recommendation segment. We've done this the last few years, and I'm just going to lead off with my resolution from last year. Last year, I had mentioned that cozy mysteries are like my comfort read, and I was interested in trying cozy mysteries that were a little different, like had more diverse authors or more diverse characters than what I've typically read. and I have to report back that I failed completely. Not only did I not read any cozies that were by diverse authors or with diverse characters, I did not read a single cozy mystery all year, which is unfortunate because I do love them. They're fun. So that brings me to my resolution for this year is that I want to just read some stuff that's fun for me. I've been reading a lot of things for the podcast and for, you know, just to broaden my perspective in general. And that's a very useful thing. But sometimes I just want to read something just pure fun, like candy. So this year I want to read
Ice Planet Barbarians.
I will consider Ice Planet Barbarians because that title just seems so fun. And I want to find other books where the title just seems fun. And probably at least one or two of them will be cozy mysteries because those are always fun. So that's my resolution for this year. And I really hope I can actually pull it off.
Well, Dennis, I share your absolute failure in keeping resolutions because last year I had two. One was to read a book by Carol Shields. And I did not do that. And it was even worse this year because over the course of the summer, my wife really got into Carol Shields. And she binge read maybe four or five books. And she said to me, "You have to read Unless." And she put it on my bedside table. It's still there.
It's short, too, that one.
I know. Yeah. It taunts me every time I climb into bed and I look over. I'm like, oh, there it is. But I've got this other thing I'm reading. Or, oh, I'll get to it. So it's still there. I mean, thank goodness for multiple renewals. So that was not great. And the other one was I was very excited to read the biography on Mike Nichols that was coming out this year. Mike Nichols, you might remember, was a movie director, but before that he was a comedian in sort of the golden age of Hollywood. He led a long life, and I thought, this is great, I'll read this. But I didn't. Instead, I picked up a new biography of Cary Grant, which I enjoyed. And I thought, you know, that's enough old Hollywood for me for a while. So I still didn't get to Mike Nichols. So this year, I'm just going to roll that Carol Shields resolution right over because I feel like until I read one, it's got to be on there. So 2022, and here comes Carol Shields.
And I have to say, this is the second time in a row you failed to read Carol Shields for your resolution. So,
yes, yes,
so
thank you, Dennis, for pointing that out. This is the third time rolling over. And then also, I just was looking ahead at 2022 and a couple of books I'm interested in reading. One is called Tracy Flick Can't Win by Tom Perrotta. Now, if Tracy Flick sounds familiar to you, Tom Perrotta wrote a novel called Election that was turned into a movie in 1999. It was one of Reese Witherspoon's first movies with Matthew Broderick. It's a very funny satire about high school elections. And so the author returns to the Tracy Flick character. Now Tracy's grown up. She's a high school assistant principal who decides to go for the top job after her boss announces retirement. So I'm looking forward to a lot of very cringy moments, a lot of humor. And then the other book I'm looking forward to is an author who we've talked about on this podcast, but we haven't read any of her books, Emily St. John Mandel. She has a new one coming out called Sea of Tranquility. And some of us have read Station 11 and the Glass Hotel. I haven't read the Glass Hotel yet. I've read Station 11. I've got Glass Hotel on my list. I think it's just a little bit above Carol Shields. So I'll get to that. And then, so that's my, those are my resolutions. Let's check in this time next year, see how badly I failed.
That just leaves me. I use Goodreads, which I know has some problematic aspects to it, but I really like Goodreads. And you can set up a reading challenge on Goodreads where you say, I'm going to read this many books a year. So 2 years ago in 2020, I set up myself to read 50 books. And the whole year I was stressed out about it. Goodreads will tell you how many books ahead you are, how many books behind you are. And like, so the whole year I was just like looking at this number and being like, oh my God, I don't know if I'm going to make it. I did. I read exactly 50 books in 2020, but it was very stressful. So this year, I decided I would just set myself a number that was easy to beat, that I would get to no problem. So I started the year with 30. And then near the end of the summer, I was getting close to that number. And I realized I could just go in and edit my challenge to change the number of books to read. So I went and I changed it. I bumped it up to 35. And then when I got close to 35, I bumped it up to 40. So all that to say, I don't think setting a goal for a number of books really works for me. So I have decided for 2022 to read a specific book. It's a classic. It was inspired by both Dennis and a booktuber I really like called Books with Emily Fox. And it is Don Quixote. So 2022, I'm going to read it. It's a big, hefty novel. I've been wanting to read it for a long time. I've been thinking I want to read it. And I think saying it out loud will really give me that kick in the butt I need to actually do it. So
you would think it would.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to knock it out early in the year and get it over with. So I'll let you know.
Good luck.
Thank you.
It is a big book, and I don't remember a lot of the details, but I do know it's a little repetitive in parts, but there's something nice about that book.
Okay,
and so now it is time for everyone's favorite segment, Nerd Words for Word Nerds, wherein our panelists try to bring out the magic of words by discussing a word or phrase that has been on our minds lately.
So this was a word that is actually in this book near the beginning of it, and it stood out to me and I noted it down, and I didn't think of or find a more interesting word since, so I went with it. And that is the word foolscap. So in common parlance, it's just a piece of writing paper, but it's a really weird word. It's not a word I say, but it's a word I know what it means when I see it. So I did do some digging. And it comes from the watermark of a fool's cap that was on paper of a certain size. And then it just became the name for that type of paper, regardless of whether the watermark was on it or not. So I thought that was really interesting, and how it's such an old word, like a word that's been around for so long. And often those words fall off. We don't use them. They fall out of fashion. But it's something that we're still using. And it's one of those words, I know every word, if you say over and over and over again, it loses meaning. But this one particularly to me, maybe just because what it is so separate from the word. So foolscap.
I have a question.
Yes.
So what is a fool's cap? Like a dunce cap?
Yeah. So There were, like, I saw an image of the watermark, and it was like kind of the head of a jester.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
When I was in elementary school, I always referred to the 8.5 by 14 paper as fool's cap.
Yeah. Huh.
And I, as a child, thought it was like fool's cap, like full, it's the full size paper. It's 14 inches long. It's longer than the regular paper. Yeah. But yeah.
You're right. It's one of those words that when you hear it, you know what it means, but you have no idea where it came from. my word this month is also inspired by our novel. It's Naija, N-A-I-J-A. And that is a word for the type of Nigerian English that has developed over the years, because Nigeria was a British colony up until 1960. And because there are so many cultural groups, languages in Nigeria, that to develop sort of a common parlance, a lingua franca in the country, this a pidgin English developed, which I thought was very interesting. That a pidgin English is sort of the first stage of a sort of a dialect. And then when it gets sort of coded or becomes a language of its own, then it's referred to as a Creole. And if you look at Nigerian English or Niger English, it's used interchangeably in some cases. And what's interesting is that in 2011, Google launched a search interface that used Naija as its search tool. And in 2017, the BBC launched the BBC News Pidgin, which is pretty interesting that you can look up the BBC News and it's written out in Nigerian English. And in 2020, the Oxford English Dictionary added 29 Nigerian English words to its dictionary, recognizing Nigeria's contribution to English as a global language. And so I thought it's not just single words, but certain phrases that come up. So I just have just a couple here as an example. So one that comes up a lot in the novel is Okada, which is the motorcycle taxi that goes all over the cities. And it's named after the defunct Okada airline that ran in Nigeria, because these Okada taxis, they're the only way you can fly around the cities. So that's how the Okadas got their name. And this is a phrase I just loved, ember months. And that refers to the last 4 months of the year, September to December. So if you're in the ember months, which we are now recording at the end of December, I just thought it was just like a lovely image of like the year burning out, and here's the ember of it. And the one that we've been doing here all day is to rub minds together, which means to consult or to confer with other people. So those are just some examples of the Naija language. There's a website, nijalingo.com, which you can find more. Or there's another one, the Nigerian English Dictionary, timetoread.com. So there's lots of places to look it up. And I just found that interesting. Nyjah.
One of my favorite words in the book was wahala. Mm. Which was translates as trouble.
Trouble.
And yeah. Often heard as no wahala, like no trouble, or yes, like I'll do this, you know.
Yeah, like no problem. Or
yeah, yeah. No wahala. I like the way it rolls off the tongue. It's lovely.
Another one, like a beg, I think, which just means like please, I think. It's just one of those words that they throw in into the novel. And it just adds just that little bit of flavor, which I loved.
Yeah. It's a beautiful sounding language or a way of talking. Like I just enjoyed that. That was nice. So for my word, I'm going to give a bit of an explanation about my mindset, which brought me to the word. So ever since I was in, I think it was high school, I got my first how to study book, because while I always did well in school, I was never terribly organized and I thought I should be more organized. And so I read a book about how to study, how to set up your desk and take notes and things like that. And I promptly, you know, forgot about it after like a month. And my life has been punctuated by these moments where I decide I will get more organized and I will take notes and I will do this and that. And so I get sucked into these little personal productivity cycles, which happens to a lot of people, I think, because there's a whole productivity industry. And this happened to me recently again. And if you're into productivity, one of the key buzzwords now is personal knowledge management. And this is where you try to not just have notes, because like 10 years ago, everyone was using Evernote and collecting every bit of knowledge they could. And they had all these notes and they didn't have any good way of getting them out again. So personal knowledge management is this idea of you can't just take notes. You got to have some way to bring them up again into your mind over and over to create like a second brain to help you with it. And one of these methodologies that became really popular recently is something called Zettelkasten, and that's my word for the month. Zettelkasten comes from the German. Zettel means little slips of paper, and Kasten means box. So it's a box with little slips of paper in it. And if that makes you think of the old card catalogs we used to have, well, that's related. Or recipes on index cards in a little box. Yep, same kind of idea. There was a sociologist named Nicholas Luhmann, who lived from 1927 to 1998, and he built up a Zettelkasten of some 90,000 slips of paper in boxes, and he came up with a system where he assigned each of them a unique identifier. Each slip only had one idea, and he would refer to other ideas by using their unique identifier, so he would have essentially hyperlinks, like a web page, but in his boxes. And he kept extensive notes, and as a result, he was able to be incredibly prolific. He published over 70 books and over 400 scholarly articles, and at his death, he actually had even more than that unpublished still sitting there. So he was able to be incredibly productive with the system. So it has become an inspiration for many people. Nowadays, of course, we have computer software that can do this linking for you, and you can get into all kinds of discussions about how to set up your Zettelkasten. Search for it on YouTube and you will find just video after video talking about people setting up their Zettelkasten. So that is my word for the month, Zettelkasten. I have not set up a Zettelkasten system and I'm not going to because I know I'm just going to fall off on this right away. But I thought it was an interesting word.
Can I sneak in a quick recommendation?
I don't know, Toby.
Well, it's the end of the year. I think we could probably make an exception this one time.
Because while I don't want to shout this book from the rooftops, I do want to shout this TV show from the rooftops. So like The Death of Vivek Oji, this TV show, it's about a non-binary transgender person of color. It's called Sort Of. Have either of you heard of it or watching it?
No.
It's a Canadian show. It's on CBC. It is about a transgender person named Sabi, who is a nanny to a family in Toronto. And it's so good. I mean, whereas the book is pretty serious and doesn't have a lot of joy, the show, while obviously dealing with some serious issues, just has a lot of comedy and funniness and optimism and hope. And it's so well cast. Like, I can't even do the caveat, it's a good show for a Canadian show. Like, it's just a good show, period. And I think it's like 8 episodes. It's on CBC Gem, so it's really accessible. And it's so good. It's so, so good.
Sounds interesting.
Nice. Yeah. We can put a link to that in our show notes.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah. So you sort of recommend it?
I 1,000% recommend it.
So unfortunately, that's all the time we have this month. Thank you for joining us, dear readers. For next month, we're reading The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. Elwood Curtis has taken the words of Dr. Martin Luther King to heart. He's as good as anyone. Abandoned by his parents, brought up by his loving, strict, and clear-sighted grandmother, Elwood is about to enroll in the local black college. But given the time and place, one innocent mistake is enough to destroy his future, and so Elwood arrives at the Nickel Academy, which claims to provide physical, intellectual, and moral training which will equip its inmates to become honorable and honest men. In reality, the Nickel Academy is a chamber of horrors where physical, emotional, and sexual abuse is rife, where corrupt officials and tradesmen do a brisk trade in supplies intended for the school, and where any boy who resists is likely to disappear out back. Stunned to find himself in this vicious environment, Elwood tries to hold on to Dr. King's ringing assertion, "Throw us in jail and we will still love you." But Elwood's fellow inmate and new friend Turner thinks Elwood is naive and worse. The world is crooked, and the only way to survive is to emulate the cruelty and cynicism of their oppressors. Have an idea about what we should read next? Let us know. You can find all our contact info at the bottom of the page at wpl-podcast.winnipeg.ca. You can also find all our past episodes and discussion questions there too. If you haven't already, subscribe to Time to Read on your favorite podcasting service, and maybe leave us a review. Tell your book-loving friends about us too. And until next time, make sure you find
Time to Read.
Present and stores aren't open, which is weird. Could you think it would be Boxing Day? And my mom loves Genie's cake, and the Genie's bakery shuts down for 2 weeks over the holidays. I guess they do like a big, I don't know what they do, clean or inventory or something.
I think it's a mercy they provide to the population.
So I can tell from, first of all, from Toby's facial reaction and Dennis that you, neither of you are on Team Genie's.
I mean, I'm not a Winnipegger, so I think that's my excuse, but it's like that bottom is cardboard. I'm convinced it's cardboard.
Most of my life, I never had one. I just heard about them. People were always like, oh, they brought a Genie's cake. It was wonderful. And it's like, oh, okay. I've never had a Genie's cake. And then in my 30s, I had one for the first time, I think it was. So I said, here you go. And I'm like, where'd you get this cake from? Well, it's a Genie's cake. This is a Genie's cake?
Oh, they're so bad.
I'll say is my mom is a proud North Ender. And so Genie's cakes were a part of her growing up. And by default or by osmosis, a part of our family tradition. So every birthday, every celebration, there's a Genie's cake, and I love them. So, but then again, I don't know how much of it is a nostalgia thing that when I eat it, I just think back of all the family gatherings, or if it is. But I mean, I really do think they're delicious.